Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, everybody. It's Sunday. That means it's the main course. We have a great show today. We're sponsored by Fairway Market, our friend Steve Jenkins and Fairway Market. We're going to have in a few minutes Shauna Pacifico, the chef of Back 40 West, in studio. And then we're going to do a very interesting call-in with Justin Rashid of American Spoon Foods out in Michigan. We're going to talk all about the terroir of Michigan. So we're going to talk a little bit in this intro about terroir. First of all, Joe is our engineer, and he just got back from South by Southwest, where he performed like 20 concerts. Welcome back, Joe.
Thank you, Patrick. Good to be back.
It was a terrible shit show without you. Things were crazy. Doors were open. Pizza was everywhere. Cheese was on the inside of our containers. It was really, really wild. So it's good to have you back.
I try to hold it down here.
What was it? Give us the headlines. Did you get picked up by a record label or anything?
No, I don't think we got picked up by a record label, but we did get a lot of good press from publications like The Guardian, and we were on some subsidiary of MTV and stuff like that. So,
like MTV7?
Yeah.
Why doesn't MTV do videos anymore? I mean, is the world so sick of videos because of what they did in the 80s and 90s that they can't do videos anymore?
I don't know. I think I'm with you on this one, that they should bring back music videos. There's already enough like trashy TV networks and everything like that. So.
Not enough people see you on radio, Joe. You know, we need to have you on television as well.
Exactly. I need to take over every form of media.
So you were just in Austin, Texas. That is a very interesting terroir. I mean, you know, the Southwest is known for its chilies and things of that nature, you know, smoky chilies. And we're about, at the end of the show, we're going to have Justin on, who's going to talk about, you know, agriculture on the edge, because, he is right on Lake Michigan. In northern Michigan, right off of Lake Michigan, you know, that whole kind of thin strip that, is adjacent to Lake Michigan. And it is so interesting, the foods that come out of an environment like that. And, there's a word I invented, which I'm very proud of, because I've only invented a couple words in my life. Some of them are like gibberish, but one is the human equivalent of terroir. Now, of course, terroir is the kind of what the soil gives to certain foods, the taste that it imparts on certain foods. And, the soil could be, you know, like the Willamette Valley, for instance, in Oregon. That has like 20 inches of topsoil. It's practically, I think it is a temperate rainforest out there. So, you know, that, and now contrast that with like the Flint Hills in Kansas. That is actually the largest remaining prairie grass zone in all of America. Prairie grass being, of course, the earth's food. These perennial plants like sunflowers and blue stems, I mean, they just kind of grow out there. And that is a great forage for livestock and free-ranging cattle and such. So each kind of zone imparts its own flavor, has its own kind of soil characteristics, drainage, exposure to sunlight, seasons, temperatures, how cool the nights are, you know, temperature variations. I mean, all these things go into food. But likewise, what also goes into the terroir is the French word for head, tête, which is a great word. And a terroir to me is, you know, the kind of skills and the hands and a place of a people. So, you know, when I was waiting for Shauna to come in, I was watching the pizza station at Roberta's. And there's terroir there. You know, there is, of course it relies on terroir because they're putting cheese on the pizza, but there's basically 10 people back there, or 5 people working the pizza station, and they're all really good pizza people, and all of their skills are building on top of the skills of the people that worked there before, and they know how hot the oven is and how the cheese is going to come out and which cheeses work and which cheeses don't, and then they're able to invent new pizzas, ones that haven't been, you know, experimented with before, and it's a very interesting thing. So I'd like to officially propose that the word tetwar gets added, and of course you can read my book, The Carnivore's Manifesto, or as Anne likes to call it, The Carnifesto. You know, we can read more about tetwar in that. But anyway, that's my intro. Terroir, tetwar. What do you think, Joe?
I think it's great. I'm going to call up Merriam-Webster right now.
Thank you. Thank you. Hopefully it could be like the word of the year. So I just found out I was like the fifth highest rated show on the network. And now that I know that people are listening to me, I don't do well with that kind of pressure. So, you know, that intro, I don't know if that was very good, but I do get nervous knowing that literally dozens and dozens of people are listening. Anyway, so we're going to take a short break. We are sponsored by Fairway Market. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we have some weird people eating pizza right in front of the window here of our two shipping containers. We'll take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about the dark side of New York City restaurant kitchens with Shauna Pacifico.
You're listening to Lung by Iggy Dean on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Who is that playing, Joe?
That was Iggy Dean.
Iggy Dean. And you have an event coming up this Wednesday night, right? You want to tell our listeners about it?
Sure. It's the right coming up this Wednesday on March 27th. It is the second of the HRN Salon series. And this one's sponsored by Tito's Handmade Vodka. And from what I've understood, this is going to be an event where we have bartenders from Roberta's, Booker and Dax, The Wren, and everyone's going to try to make like an awesome vodka cocktail because vodka kind of gets a bad rap these days. And so we're going to, you know, use some Tito's vodka, try to make some delicious drinks.
Because they say vodka doesn't taste of anything, so it revolves less skill of the barman because you can just put orange juice in it and it already tastes good. You know?
Right, exactly. You can't really do anything super unique with it, I guess, is what the complaint with vodka is. So yeah, it's going to be on the 27th.
How do you get tickets?
The tickets are at huntingforvodka.eventbrite.com.
Oh my God. All right, well, good. Well, all the other domain names were taken. That is a most complicated event thing. So you can't just go to heritageradionetwork.org and sign up?
There may be a button on the website. Let me check that out. But as far as I know, it's just huntingforvodka.eventbrite.com.
God. And Bright isn't even spelled like you would think, right?
It's B-R-I-T-E, correct.
That's a crazy website. All right, well, we are in studio with Shauna Pacifico. Welcome, Shauna.
Thank you.
And it is so nice to see you. So did you work the Saturday night shift at Back 40 West last night?
Nope, I actually worked Saturday brunch shift at Back 40 West.
What is brunch? Is it reusing all the items that you weren't able to use over the course of the week, kind of like combo, or does brunch have its own?
It has its own menu, own dishes, own prep time. It's a brand new menu.
So now, as the head of this restaurant, which of course was started originally by Peter Hoffman, and then you know you ran Back 40, and now Back 40 West is what the old Savoy is called. So you're the head chef there. What does that mean your schedule is? I mean, I presume you have to be on call all the time, but what hours do you actually work?
Yeah, I guess that's true. I am on call all the time, even at 7 a.m. when somebody doesn't show up for their morning shift. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's 10 to 12 hours a day. I do normally 5 days a week unless there's a special event, and then I'm, you know, picking up. And as in, I don't normally don't work Mondays, but I'll be working this Monday for Passover. We're having a Passover Seder dinner at Back 40 West. So it's my first time cooking Jewish food.
Oh, very nice, very nice. So what's on the menu? Gefilte fish, matzah, the usual?
No, matzah ball soup.
Okay.
We're basically doing, I think it's like food from the Sephardic Jews or something like that. There's like a mezze plate, some smoked chicken, and a flourless chocolate cake because you can't eat.
You can't eat flour on that day.
I guess so.
So now, these daily Passovers, obviously an exception as our special events. But, you know, presuming that none of these things exist, you know, it's just a regular week, just a regular five-day week. I mean, you must have had to work very hard to develop daily systems for your restaurant. I mean, is that, talk about these daily systems, and are they set now in stone, or are they constantly changing because of the nature of the job?
Well, they are constantly changing. There's certain things that are set in stone, and it's nice to finally figure out what you're going to set into stone. You know, anywhere from where are we putting the sheet pans, and where are we storing the bread when we're not using it, those things take, you know, we just passed our first year being open, so I'd say some things are still fluctuating of, you know, where does this particular pan live when it's not being used? You know, and we're sometimes searching for those things. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but when you're, you know, working in a busy environment, a small kitchen in New York City, it's important to figure out where these things go and where they live.
And what is the goal with, like, where things are placed? Like, the minimum amount of movement to get to them when you need them, and putting important things close to you and not important things far?
That's exactly what it is. Is like, you know, it's something you don't use very often is wrapped up and put away in the stairs. You know, where we store things, the stairs that go up to the upstairs dining room.
Can you put food by the stairs or no?
Well, yeah, I keep vinegars and stuff like that. I have a shelf there for, you know, the big bottles of vinegars and baking powder and that kind of stuff that doesn't necessarily need to be on the station.
So tell some of our listeners things that you keep close. Obviously, I presume salt and things like that. But, I mean, some things that we might not think about and things that you don't need and that are kind of, you know, far away at the edges of the kitchen.
Well, you basically keep everything close, all your spices and all that stuff. The difference is that you always have a backup that's further away. You know, I don't need to keep a 50-pound bag of flour on the station because I'm not going to necessarily need that during service. But I might have a quart of flour on station. Obviously, all your, you know, your mise en place, your prep, your the food that goes into each dish needs to be on the station, but it's a little bit. You know, you have a pint or a quart or a small container or one sheet pan of chicken, and then you have 60 more orders down in your walk-in. So that's another thing that happens a lot during service is how many times you have to get refilled because the actual space you're working off of can only allow so much food to be there. And then you run through one dish, you know, you randomly sell 10 chickens and you're like, crap, I gotta go get it. Somebody go get my chicken.
And that kind of breaks up your flow, right? I mean, you're basically trying to stay in flow zone and just be whipping it out. You're in a zone and then things break that.
Yeah, no, you definitely, that's, you know, that's the first thing I do at the like, top of service is I always ask my cooks. I was like, all right, it's 5:30. We're open. I was like, you're fully set. You have all your backups. You know where they are. You know what you need. You have enough to get through at least the next 2 hours. Like, you're not going to tell me in a half hour after we open that you don't have chicken on your station.
So you have to leave for 20 minutes.
Not even 20, even 10 minutes, because that doesn't, you know, you have to at least set yourself up so that you're like set for the first rush, and then you always get a little break or somebody can run downstairs and get stuff.
Now what happens if a table for six comes in and you find out that they're all vegans? Are you able to go to the edges of the kitchen and the ingredient zone and bring it in and do such a thing, or are you unable to do such a thing?
Sure, vegan is harder for us to do, and personally harder for me to support. I understand.
Can those people eat salad?
Yeah, it's basically, you just take something off the menu and alter it. But it's, you know, so they're eating a lot of salads and sides or just plain vegetables generally. Vegetarians are easier to accommodate.
Do you always keep a certain amount of vegetarian dishes as main courses and such?
Always one main course and always a few appetizers or salads. Like if I have two salads, one will have a protein and one will be vegetarian. And I generally like to try to keep a vegan appetizer on as well. Just not for the vegans, but just for somebody who just wants something light that doesn't need to be laden with cheese or meat or, and, you know, any of those sorts of things.
So now, where do breakdowns happen? Despite your best efforts to marshal your chefs to be on the ball and to be able to predict what the audience is going to ask for you, there are all types of events that we were just talking about before the show that break your flow.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about them each, because I think people, when we say it, they'll be like, oh, yeah. But if you're like, why? Why would Shauna come home ballistic after a day's work? But shit happens. So let's start. Equipment breaking down.
Yeah.
What, your oven breaks? I mean, what kind of blenders?
It's like Murphy's Law. I find that the oven or the fryer or the grill won't light, and it always happens either late Friday night or Saturday. And, like, you can't get anybody to come in and fix it on a Saturday. And if you do, you're paying triple the price for them to come in on a Saturday or, like, Saturday night into Sunday.
Do you have people on your team that know how to fix things like this? The reefer unit?
Peter Hoffman.
He does?
Well, he knows how to fix a lot of things. He's
learned over the years.
Yeah, he's owned that, you know, he's owned Savoy for over 20, you know, over 20 years and in Back 40 West and Back 40, so...
Is it usual that equipment breaks down, though? I mean, shouldn't it work forever?
Oh, no. I mean, we're not even a year old, and within 6 months, we had to replace a $700 part on our brand new fryer.
Because you're just working it very hard.
Well, it's just, you know, sometimes the equipment isn't made the way it is, and it's not, you know, it's always something that's not under warranty or... you know, or it happens on a Saturday, so you have to bring somebody else to fix it, so then it's really not under warranty.
No, tell us, and so equipment breaking, and are you good at fixing stuff?
I'm good at,
takes tetwar.
It does take tetwar.
Experience over many years.
After a year of being in that place, refrigeration breaking down is a big one, especially in the summer when it's hot out and all, you know, our compressors are kept in the basement. So a lot of times in the summer, my time in the basement is spent cooling down the compressors, putting ice on them, putting a fan on them, taking anything away that's like blocking the flow of air. And I can spend 2 hours a day doing that because
you can never be closed.
Yeah, you can never be closed. And if
you're closed one time, it's a disaster because people are like, what, Back 40's closed? What happened?
Well, yeah. And if my walk-in happens to break down and the health department walks in.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about health department.
Yeah, that's a big shutdown.
So that breaks flow.
That's
what, do they just show up and surprise you?
They don't. They used to have
call
to
ahead.
Announce. No, they announce themselves at the door. I mean, they still do that. But the difference is now at Back 40 West and even at Savoy as well, you can see the kitchen from the front door. So they just flash their card and then they walk straight to the kitchen. And, you know,
what are they looking for?
Oh.
Lack of hair nets, not wearing gloves. What?
No hats, not wearing gloves, food out of temperature. You know, so they'll come in at the most crucial time as you're cooling down your chicken that came out of the smoker and you're cooling down your braise that was in the oven. And if you're not properly cooling it down or anything that's on your station out of temperature that's perishable. As much as even now they're getting us for pickles. Mm. If I have cut pickles on my station, that's a violation.
Now let me ask, are most restaurants in New York City constantly violating these rules or some small...
Yes.
Yeah, right? Oh, because
absolutely.
You can't be on top of it.
I mean, I don't want my cooks to wear gloves the whole service so that they can't touch the food and that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, the gloves impart a sort of flavor. Sure, if you're plating a salad and it's, you know, keeps your station cleaner to wear gloves, then that's great. But to squeeze a lemon on a piece of fish, that's considered, you know, your hand in contact with the food. I don't need you to put a glove on.
Are their rules fair, though? I mean, obviously they have to be on the outside.
Do they listen to this program?
No, trust me. I always wondered that. I mean, they're such idiots, because if they were to really want to test things, they should go and act like customers.
I mean, I was actually just thinking about this the other day, like on the line, because we're expecting them to come, because we sort of know the date when they're coming.
How?
They come cycle. Either the 6 months or a year from the last inspection. So we've been, you know, waiting for them and doing test runs and making, you know, just kind of constantly making sure that people aren't leaving things to cool down for too long and keeping it out of temperature. And one of the things that I've gotten a few times is cheese being out of temperature. And I was just thinking the other day, I was like, one of these days I'm going to blow up at a department health guy and be like, do you understand how cheese is made?
Yeah.
It's made out of temperature. It is kept out of temperature.
So they are unfair, years. These rules.
They just don't understand. I was like, why would you, you know, fermentation is not allowed. I've got a bucket of daikon fermenting hidden in the office behind the printer, and the whole office smells like farts because it doesn't smell good because it's a radish, you can't keep it like out of temperature. Mm. Pickles. I mean, these are things that we've been doing for thousands of years to preserve food,
and they don't like it just because it's complicated to deal with.
It's complicated to deal with. They don't understand it. I mean, if I had a store bought pickle.
Yeah,
you know, a jar on the counter, they're like, they wouldn't even think about looking at it. But it's because if we're preserving and doing our thing, I understand there's certain reasons that the Department of Health exists. It's needed. Mm-hmm. People need to be kept in check. But they don't understand. They don't really.
Well, they're just trying to do their job easy. Like in Europe, it seems like these agencies work with the restaurants and with the food producers to try to understand what's going on a microbial level, bacterial level, because they're like, we got to figure this out.
Sure.
Versus
absolutely.
Here, they're just like, hey, this is off our list of accepted things. Sorry, no. Throw it out.
NOMA just got, what, 65 people, like, you know, deathly ill, not deathly ill, but like really sick.
NOMA, restaurant?
You haven't heard about that? Yeah, NOMA.
What happened?
They poisoned like 60. I don't know the story.
People, someone didn't clean their hands after going
poopy? No, well, it probably has more to do with the cryovac stuff, you know?
Oh.
And sous vide, I bet. I mean, and that's a big problem. You put something warm in a bag in a warm bath.
It's like where they cook it at like room temperature. Yeah, like, and if you don't.
And that's, I mean, that's a dangerous way to cook. It's, you know, it's more dangerous, I think, to do that than to eat slightly undercooked chicken because you have to really know what you're doing.
Are the people suing them?
Can
you sue for getting sick?
Sure. We've been sued.
Oh, my God. So let's talk. Now, on that same kind of vein, this is an interesting question. We didn't talk about it. So when the health department guy comes, I can imagine things are a little bit more, quote-unquote, stressed, breaking you out of your flow of running the restaurant in the way you would like. What about the opposite, a food reviewer? Someone who's technically supposed to come. Is that going to change your energy?
Are you going to
be like, come on, don't screw up? Or are you guys going to just be like, come on, we've been doing this for 6 months?
No. Every restaurant in this city, in this country, when the reviewer walks in, everything stops. I mean, service has to continue, but that is the most, if you know that they're there, it is the most important thing. Not only their table, but every table that's around them. If you overcook somebody's steak next to them, they're gonna pay attention to that.
Now, let me ask though, I mean, isn't it just carrying out your normal operating procedures and just being extra vigilant? Or it just must create stress. You're like, all right, everybody, we're getting the second visit from X.
It creates stress. I mean, it is normal operation. You can focus and do a really good job, but you're only going to do as good as you are.
Right, exactly. So you have to really be the best in those situations.
You have to really be the best at that situation.
So let's get into annoying people. Parties, reservations. I mean, are you constantly coming in and talking to the front of the house, being like, Peter Hoffman's wife, she thought it was going to be a two-top, now it's an eight-top, so what, we're going to move to what table? I mean, is it just a shit show every day?
No, it's not a shit show every day. I mean, there's definitely some sort of organization, but there's always a table, a customer request, or a party showing up late, that all, and every service that throws a wrench into things.
How late are you allowed to come and you still hold the table?
We usually do, you know, we don't take reservations, but if you, and we don't sit, and that's why a lot of these places don't sit and complete parties, because you're like, oh, my friend's right around the corner. Not, you know, around the corner, it means a lot of different things.
Yeah, they could be taking a shower around the corner and still be an hour away.
You know, so we don't take reservations. So we say check in when your party is complete. Mm-hmm. And then you go on the wait list. Like, why should you go on the wait list before of another four top that is all there, and has been there.
So does this affect you in the kitchen, though? I mean, does anyone have to come back to you and be like, the six top is now going to be an hour later? I mean, does that matter for you, or are you just waiting for the little order sheet to come in through the computer system?
No, it does matter. The flow of the service, the how many tables it gets sat at one time, or how fast the tickets come in the kitchen.
Is there a limit on how many tables can be sat at one time, or do you tell the waitresses hold up on the top floor because I'm overwhelmed?
Yeah, I mean, there's not necessarily, we don't have a set limit. I'm sure some restaurants may, but we you know, we want to sit people as fast as possible. But, for example, if you have an empty dining room and then you sat and all of a sudden 50 people walked mm-hmm. in the door within 15 minutes of each other, you need to, as the person working the door, and the servers and the managers, you need to like sort of stretch that out a little bit. You can't just bam, 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 take everybody's order, because mm-hmm. it's just going to clog the kitchen up. You can't get that much food out at once. A small kitchen, you know, where, you know, there's only three line cooks in that kitchen. Bigger restaurants deal with it differently. They've got hundreds of cooks, or not hundreds, but, you know, 20 cooks.
Well, you didn't answer the question. So let's say a six top reserves at 8, and uh-huh. now it's 8:30.
Uh-huh.
Do you give up their table?
If nobody showed or called, that, yeah, absolutely.
What about if two people were there? What's the limit? I mean, when is too much too much? Because I show up 10 minutes late, I'm petrified that the restaurant's going to be pissed, especially sure. if I know the people.
Sure. That's more of a... The part doesn't really affect me.
Yeah, yeah.
It's more about larger groups of, you know, 15 or 20 that have reserved a special menu, and then, you know, we try to keep them out of the prime time. There's no 8 o'clock reservations. You come earlier, you come later, just because it's easier to serve them better.
Can you take a 15 top and let them all order off the menu, or do you have to do a
Well,
set menu
we
over?
Can if you can do that at our restaurant. If you do this, if you want to come in the same day or just walk in,
sure.
But if you want to reserve a table and not wait, you have to choose. What we do is a chef tasting menu. It's a menu mainly chosen by me. Day of the event.
Now, are parties pains in the butts? I mean, how are they pains in the butts? What do they ask of you? Are they like, oh, and we don't want this, and we want salmon, which you don't have on the menu? I mean, or are most parties basically ready just to play the back 40 game?
Most parties are. There's the real pain nowadays is all the gluten allergies, and you'll have three people will eat fish but don't eat meat, and then but one guy, you know, the guy that's throwing the party really wants pork, so then you have to sort of figure that out. And sometimes in those cases it almost feels like just let them order whatever they want. You know, we try to create an experience for them.
Now let's talk about just frustrating dishes that are so hard to make. I've had two interesting people. I always give them as examples, but Cruz Goler has been the chef of Lupa for all these years. He's like, I still cannot trust my sous chefs who've been there for many years to do the simple pasta, cacio e pepe. You know, it's just cacio cavallo, I guess, is a cheese mm-hmm. and pepper, because there's no margin of error. It's so easy to screw up. Then 2 weeks later, I had Sean Heller from Momofuku here, mm-hmm. and he's like, oh, ramen? Oh, it's different every time. I am not an expert enough to make simple ramen come out the same every single time.
Yeah.
That was just so intense to me, because I figured, how hard could it be? But, you know, only someone who will become a master will admit that they're not there yet, even after a decade. So are there still poaching an egg or dishes that just break your flow in the kitchen?
I still am horrible at poaching eggs. I'm working, you know, on Saturdays I'll work the line on brunch, and I'll work the egg station. And every time I'm doing, I'm like, why am I doing this to myself? I still can't get, like, I can do them.
Why?
But, like, it's just variables. You know, you don't have the right kind of pot. Your pot's, it's too thin, so it doesn't distribute the heat correctly, so the eggs are sticking. Or the eggs are old, so when you throw them in the water, they spread out everywhere. Like, if you don't have fresh eggs, they're horrible for, you know, old eggs are horrible for poaching.
So is that your biggest nemesis? I mean, that are there dishes on the menu some weeks or months?
No,
of the
I mean
year?
You just I mean you reminded me talking about the not trusting the sous chef to do a simple thing. our pork face nuggets at Back 40 West they're very labor intensive.
Not jowl nuggets.
No, they? They're not jowl nuggets. I'm sorry, I've sort of went to the whole head. There's a lot of different steps, and it's pretty basic, but the flavoring of the actual pork nugget is really intense. And if you put too much salt or not enough salt, then it just doesn't come out very good. And I, you know, recently, you know, I did Cochon 555 and I did these, nuggets there, and my cooks, you know, and I made sure I did everything, and my cooks were like, he's like, oh, we haven't had nuggets like these in a long time. I'm like, yeah, this is what they're supposed to taste like. Don't you understand? This is why, so like, and that's, you know, a really hard thing is, you know, recently I had somebody make a comment about the food at Back 40 West that it's simple. And that's true. It's simple. It's straightforward. But there's nothing simple about preparing it. There's nothing simple about keeping the consistency. That's hard work. That's hard. And it requires me and my sous chef, or, you know, me being on top of everybody, and Peter coming in and tasting it and being like, I came in and ate, and this, I don't think this is how you want it, you know.
So let's talk about that. Staffing issues. I mean, that must be the number one thing. Politics.
Yeah. Well, staffing issue. I think there's
Does it
a
break
real,
your flow?
Yeah. If you have somebody who's not really dedicated or doesn't really want to be there or isn't quite working out, doesn't quite fit in that sort of environment, those are all sorts of issues. Training cooks to push themselves and become better, is another issue of constantly, you know, trying to teach them and keep them excited in what they're doing, because
they don't. I mean, it's not their name on the menu.
No, it's not their name.
Owners, so they might,
you know, cooks
interest.
Are cooks are in a restaurant to gain experience and gain knowledge. And if I can't keep them excited and interested in something, you know, just working a line, just being a line cook is not very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
The exciting part is doing new dishes and working with new product and breaking down new animals.
So how do you how do you not be a bitch, but also get the most out of them? Because, I mean, sometimes you probably have to, like a horse, you have to whip them hard or
that's
not at all.
That's been my New Year's resolution of trying, still
to
working.
To be more of a bitch or less?
No, less of a bitch.
Okay.
Just to calm down, you know, when something happens and somebody messes up, my first initial reaction is to freak out and be like, what the F are you doing? And is to sort of like go back from that and say, okay, what's really the issue here? What's, you know, what am I doing wrong that they're doing something wrong? What am I not providing and support in this kitchen?
Mm.
And is this, going back to the dish, is this dish not really functional for this station? Is this too much? Is it too many pans or too many steps to put this dish on a plate?
Absolutely fascinating. Do you have any events that are coming up in the next few days or weeks that you want to tell us about?
Yeah,
and is there a website, by the way?
There is it's Back 40 NYC is a website for both Back 40s. We always have some exciting things happening.
You're doing Googa Mooga again?
We're doing, not again. This is our first time doing Googa Mooga. We are doing Googa Mooga, which is huge. Huge. I mean, it's, you know, we're supposed to make 4,000 portions for the weekend. And
what are you making, jowl nuggets?
No, we're actually going to do smoked lamb. Mm. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it because they haven't released the press release, but oh well. Yeah, we're going to do smoked.
Have, like, yogurt?
Yeah, it's a harissa smoked lamb shoulders
Labna?
With yogurt and a grain salad.
Anne and I ever taken you to our favorite Middle Eastern restaurant, Tannerine in Bay Ridge?
Oh, no.
Oh, man. That sounds good. I love
those flavors. The labneh, the harissa, the spices, the
tabbouleh, baba ghanoush, hummus. Yeah, that's the best way to eat in the world.
Oh, it's great.
If I was ever cursed never to have, you know, if the doctor was like, you can't eat meat again, I would literally invest in a Middle Eastern restaurant in my basement.
Like, this is where I'm going to eat every day.
Pay for an Arab person to work down there because it is just so delicious.
Yeah, they bring so many flavors to the simplest products.
So you love that. And then is there a I know you speak Portuguese. Fala português muito bem, não bem como eu, oi, yo, but still pretty good. So, do you think that there is a connection between Middle Eastern food and Brazilian food?
Oh, absolutely. Brazil is as diverse as the U.S. is in cultures, and there's been a lot of immigration to Brazil as well, so
there's a big mix. Everything's
a big mix. Yeah.
So you're doing Gugamuga.
Gugamuga. One exciting event that we're definitely doing, and this is Peter's like favorite event. It's my favorite event. It's the Calçotada.
What the hell?
It's the Spanish festival celebrating spring. Ah. So the calçots, which are the onions that they start growing before winter, and then once the snow falls, they cover them up with dirt, and then they wait for spring. The first time, so they're like the first things that, you know, they're wintered over like giant green onion leeks. So you grill the whole thing, you char them black, you wrap them in paper, you steam them in a cooler, and then you just serve them with romesco sauce, and you dip it with your hands, and you drink lots of rosé wine out of a porón. We grill out on the street, and then later comes grilled lamb and beans and butifarra sausage. No.
It sounds like a good food cost for you. You're like, we just cook one big vegetable. It's the best tradition.
Well, no, there's lamb and all that, but it's a lot of fun, and it's a big drinking. You know, it's basically chugging rosé wine.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second. Hey, Joe, can you get Justin on the line?
Justin is waiting on the line right now.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, I will say all things are in spring because that's when if you've survived the winter, it was time to party.
It was time to
You would eat fiddleheads and all these like early growing things. Now, we're about to hear, I had to have Justin on, and I told Aaron to have him on as well because he is an agriculture on the edge, and his spring is actually an extension of winter, and his early winter is actually an extension of the fall and summer because of this lake effect. So we're really going to probably the most fascinating story on terroir I've heard in America. So Justin, thanks so much for calling in today on a Sunday.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Patrick.
Can you talk about the history of American spoon foods with Larry Forgione back in the 80s?
Well, I probably should begin in the 70s. Because back in 1978, I was operating a little roadside market that I had named the Whole Food Store, believe it or not, where I was selling, local foods and natural foods to a kind of a summer clientele up in northern Michigan. And a customer of mine moved to New York to go into the performing arts. And as we all know, when you move to New York City to go in the performing arts, you often end up with a career in food service.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a server at the River Cafe.
The historic River Cafe.
When she came back the next year, she said, this intense chef that I work with there at the cafe, he wanted me to find somebody in northern Michigan to pick some kind of wild mushroom for him. And I can't even remember what it is. And I said, well, he obviously wants morels. Give me his number. And I've been picking him since I was 13 years old, and I'd be happy to pick morels for him. And
so you grew up in this environment.
That's how we met. And then, so I became a forager for Larry at the River Cafe there in Brooklyn. And pretty soon half the things on the menu were wild foods and foods that I purveyed from northern Michigan. And I talked him into coming out to northern Michigan, I think it was in 1980, because my friend had the largest buffalo herd east of the Mississippi that he was raising here. And I picked Larry up at the airport, and as I was driving him down to Traverse City, he noticed this body of water to the west, and he said, you know, what is all this water out here? We've been passing this water for 50 miles. I said, well, you know, that's Lake Michigan, Larry. It's one of the Great Lakes. And he said, how big is it? I said, well, you know, very big. It's 100 miles to Wisconsin and 350 miles down to Chicago. And he said, wow, that's amazing. And what are all these trees that grow in perfect symmetry and perfect rows along the road here? And I said, well, those are orchards. We're in one of the most ideal microclimates in the world for tree fruit culture, for stone fruits and cherries and apples and peaches and those kinds of things. And then the very next thing he said was, well, can you make jam? And I said, well, gee, I assume I can. I watched my mother do it all the years I was growing up. Everybody does it here. I'll tell you what, you give me a recipe, and I'll find a fruit, and we'll make jam. And we were both about, we would have been 28, 29 years old at that point, and we didn't know any better. And so we set up a kitchen in a basement of a candy store, and we started to make fruit preserves from Michigan fruits.
So, Justin, tell me, what do you mean when you say Western Michigan is agriculture on the edge? Can you talk a little bit about this lake effect?
Sure. I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, we're so far north up here that that microclimate would not, I mean, that fruit belt that borders Lake Michigan for hundreds of miles would not exist if it were not for the lake effect. It's a little strip, a narrow strip of land on the western side of Michigan, and the lake effect makes it possible to grow wonderful fruits there. It is an edge. It's the edge of a state. It's on the border of the lake shore. It only exists a few miles. And I also mean that the small family fruit growers whose farms, there must be 2,400 farms along that entire strip, but their average size is maybe 40 to 60 acres, and it's a lifestyle. And for the fruit growers, you know, their lifestyle is, their way of life is kind of agriculture on the edge. They live on the edge of their tractor seat, so to speak, especially in recent years due to the fluctuating weather patterns that have such a profound effect on how much fruit they yield in a given year.
Well, let's talk about that lake effect. So, I mean, let's start just to be random. Take us in the deepest winter. I mean, you know, it's January and you have 10 feet of snow on the ground, and take us all the way through the cycle of a year. And just to describe to our listeners really what terroir can mean. So what is the lake effect? Take us, you know, like I say, starting in January 1st.
Okay, I'll give you the ideal. This is the way we like the lake effect to work. In January, we like there to be a couple of feet of snow on the ground, as there typically is. And it gets very, very cold, but the lake is taking a night that may be 10 below zero, and within a few miles of the lake, maybe it's only zero. Mm-hmm. And the depth of the snow is protecting the roots of the trees and moderating the coldest winter days, okay? So that's what's happening in the winter, is that protection of the root systems from the extreme cold. Then as spring comes, the lake is frozen. And where it's not frozen, the water under the ice, of course, is extremely cold.
Now, Justin, the weather comes from the west, right?
Right. So, the prevailing winds, as we know, are always from the west. You know, in the winter, they're from the northwest, and then in the summer, they're from the southwest, but they're always from the west. So, as those first warm winds of spring come across that vast mass of ice and cold water, it's like a giant air conditioner or a refrigerator. The temperature of those breezes drops. You know, if you walk along the lakeshore at that time of year, you have to wear your coat or your jacket, because you will feel the lake effect. And what this does, it postpones the trees, the orchards from coming to life and blossoming too soon. Because if those trees blossom before the risk of frost has passed, the little delicate parts of the blossom will freeze, and there will not be any fruit. So so that's what we want in the spring. We want that cold air, those hot breezes to be cooled way down and keep the trees in a dormant state for a longer period of time. Mm. Then we get into summer. In summer, the lake has still not warmed that much. And so it's moderating the warmest summer days. And fruit trees basically shut down at 85 degrees and above. Hmm. Well, the lake keeps those few miles within the shore moderated. So let's say, you know, if you went 20 miles inland, the temperature might be 90 degrees. But along the lakeshore, it may only be 80. Hmm. And then the nights, of course, once the sun goes down, the nights get very cool, and that slows the development of the fruit, which is good. And it brings abundant rainfall. As the weather comes in across the lake, it picks up moisture, and they get a lot more rain during the summer.
Is there a lot of topsoil there? I mean, what is the soil?
Well, we're talking about kind of duny hill lands that were formed by a combination of glaciers in some places, but most of them are duny hill lands where the prevailing wind has piled up hills of sand over thousands of years. And in some places, I mean, we've got a national lakeshore here, Sleeping Bear Dunes, where the dunes are actually 500 feet high. But I mean, most places they're say a couple of hundred feet high, and that sandy loam from those dunes allows the roots of the trees to spread out, and that's really important because it anchors the tree against strong winds, and it also brings nutrients in from a much wider circumference and moisture in, so it makes the trees more drought resistant and brings in trace minerals and anchors the tree. And then those hills are very important because when we do get into a frosty situation, think of cold air as a liquid that flows downhill. Well, you sight the fruit trees, the cherry trees, for example, on the upper part of a slope, and the cold will literally run downhill away from the tree and prevent it from getting any damage.
So I'm sorry to have interrupted, though. You were in the summer thing. That's fascinating about to understand the landscape of it all. But so now we're in summer, and it's it's actually a little bit cold. So, of course, these fruit are taking longer to grow, right, because everything is kind of slowed down.
Right, and the fruit is developing more character and more flavor. Mm-hmm. As it develops more slowly. If it was a very hot, wet climate, the fruit would develop very, very quickly and would be very high in moisture. But we have kind of the opposite, a very gradual development, very moderated weather, not too hot, and the fruit develops, you know, in an ideal environment if everything works right.
And now even in the summer, as you get into fall and the beginning of winter, actually, the lake effect has the opposite effect. It actually keeps things warmer for longer
because
the winds come from the west. They're heated by Lake Michigan. And so when they hit your little belt there of fruit trees, it's actually warmer. So you get these very sweet, right? I mean, doesn't that increase the sweetness?
It extends the growing season, especially for the fall fruits, the apples and the pears. And some of the other things that grow here, but yeah, you know, it's a very pleasant place to be along the lakeshore in October, for example, because if the wind is cool, it's moderated by the warmth radiating right out of the water.
And just north of you are these prairies and meadows, and basically you are the northernmost bastion of non-animal agriculture.
That's right. Exactly.
Very interesting. So just very briefly, Justin, could you, because we're going to have you on the network again and we'll expand on all this stuff, could you tell us very briefly about your fruit and your farmers and your website, just so that people could know what to be looking for if they log on?
Well, sure. What we really try to do is find special varieties of fruits that I think are best represent. I mean, what's the peachiest peach in the world? What's the most perfect blueberry that's the ideal blueberry or the quintessential strawberry? We try to find those varietals, and then we preserve them with as little sugar as we can, as much fruit and as little sugar as we can, to try to represent the standard for, you know, the greatest Red Haven peach preserve or Early Glow strawberry preserve. And you can read all about those on our website. That's spoon.com. And much of our product, the majority of our products are sold directly to our customers around the country. And well, they buy cases.
I probably first met you, Justin, when I went to the River Cafe with my mom in the 80s, but I didn't were behind it. And now, you know, from the Zingerman's days with Todd Wickstrom all the way to today with the network, it's a pleasure to have known you all these years, and it is absolutely fascinating. I think not enough Americans know exactly the power of terroir and what's going on in our own country right here. And I really hope more people log on to our website and learn about this because it is truly, truly fascinating. Thank you so much, Justin, and I look forward to hearing you in the coming weeks on other shows on the network.
My pleasure, Patrick. I've enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for calling.
As always. And Shauna Pacifico, thank you. We should have talked about the lake effect of your name, the Pacifico versus the Atlantico. But we are engineered by Joe Galarraga. And I want to thank Erin Fairbanks for being the executive director of the radio network.
Thank you, Erin.
Yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk about her. And stay tuned for Straight No Chaser, The Mike and Judy Show, and then The Morning After. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.